From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with writer Tom Wolfe. The pioneer of new journalism has just written his first novel. Also today, I continue my talk with Canadian writer Farley Mowat. He's best known for his book Never Cry Wolf. He writes about the biological and spiritual interdependence of animals and people. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Nothing Like the Sun, the second solo album from Sting. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Suspect, starring Dennis Quaid and Cher. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Radical chic and the me decade are just two of the expressions coined by Tom Wolfe. New journalism is the tag that was given the style he wrote in and championed. The new journalism used the techniques of fiction, descriptive scene setting, dramatic tension, and dialogue. And as far as Wolfe was concerned, new journalism wiped out the novel as literature's main event. In his new and flamboyant style, Wolfe wrote about Ken Kesey's LSD experiments in the book Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test. Wolfe's essay Radical Chic mocked white liberals eating fancy hors d'oeuvres at a fundraising party for the Black Panthers. And The Right Stuff conveyed the macho drive of America's astronauts. Tom Wolfe, the journalist who once called contemporary fiction retrograde, recently wrote his first novel. It's titled The Bonfire of the Vanities, and it's been on the bestseller list for about half a year. I spoke with Tom Wolfe from the NPR Bureau in New York. Since his journalism appropriated the techniques of fiction, I asked him if he used his journalistic skills in researching the novel.
I tried to. I spent, I don't even want to admit how many years doing reporting and research. Well, I guess it must have been, it was, you know, a good 2.5 years doing reporting and research for this novel, because I wanted it to be as completely grounded in fact, in terms of the situations, as anything in nonfiction. In fact, I had originally intended to do a nonfiction Vanity Fair based on Thackeray's Vanity Fair, only would be in nonfiction. And finally, when I had sort of the breathing spell to do it, I said, wait a minute, I think I'll just turn it over. I have, having never done a novel, and do a novel, but prepare for it as if I were writing nonfiction.
Do you see this novel as bringing you work full cycle?
No, I haven't thought of it that way at all. At first, it was a piece of curiosity. I was curious as to what would happen if I did try to do a novel. I was curious about just sort of throwing down this challenge to myself. I have bad mouthed contemporary fiction so much.
That's right.
It's just awful.
I was going to get to that.
I've been a little outrageous about it. And so I said, even though I'm asking for a lot of trouble, I'm just going to throw down the gauntlet to myself and see what will happen if I do it. And having done that, I'll say I'm now going to try to prove that not only possible to write a realistic, even naturalistic fiction about today, but that it's desirable to do it. So I also wanted to prove a literary point.
You've always mocked journalists who aspired to write a novel as if that were a higher calling than journalism was. And now I've been wondering if you've always been a closet wannabe novelist yourself.
Well, I at the very least, I didn't want to reach the point where I reach the end of my career and look back and say, gee, I wonder what would have happened if I'd ever written a novel. Because, you know, all of us, if we're serious about writing, and it was as true when I was in college as it is when people are in college today, all of us start off with the idea that if you're going to write, you're going to write a novel. And that's the way I started off. But then I became fascinated in the early 60s with the notion of experimenting in nonfiction. That's been the great passion of my career. But I said, all right, I'm going to take this detour. I really thought of it as more of a detour than the completion of a cycle. I felt in a way that I had completed a kind of cycle when I finished The Right Stuff. I had done a lot of things that I had wanted to do in nonfiction. So I figured, well, if there's any natural time for me to try a novelist right now.
Your new novel explores several different cultures within New York City. One of them is The Haves, and the main character is an investment banker who's finding it hard to save any money on his $1 million a year income.
Yes.
And he thinks of himself as a master of the universe, someone who can't be a saint because he's a master of the universe and he's too busy and he has too much responsibility. What genre of person do you think that is? Is this a person who typifies a certain attitude in the 80s?
I think it's quite typical of the 80s, that which is a period of tremendous prosperity at certain among certain people in large cities. There's probably never been a period of such prosperity, and particularly in New York, where the world of investment manipulation has created a gigantic industry, by now far and away the biggest industry in terms of dollars and in some ways in terms of just sheer numbers of people in New York City. And it leads, the colossal accumulation of money leads to the belief among those who have it that this accomplishment translates into all areas of life, and that if you are able to make a lot of money, let's say on Wall Street, that you're also able to do anything else that you want to do with your life. In other words, that you are able somehow to be a master of the universe. And this is a great pitfall in every area when you start thinking you can translate an ability in one area into the rest of your life.
So we have the haves and the have-nots in your novel, the haves being symbolized by this, or epitomized by this investment banker, and the have-nots epitomized by your characters in the South Bronx. And the haves are always thinking that they're about to be under attack by the have-nots, and that their Mercedes is going to be damaged, or that they're going to be mugged on the street, or maybe their house will be robbed. Do you think that that sums up a certain paranoia in Manhattan in the 80s?
There is an attempt more in the 80s. I've lived in New York for 25 years. I've never seen it quite as bad as it is now. The feeling that if you have anything, you've got to insulate yourself from the rest of the city, and above all, insulate yourself from the South Bronx. That's why I chose the South Bronx. Even though you could make the argument that there are a couple of places in Brooklyn that are as rough, if you are a Mercedes owner from Park Avenue, as the South Bronx, I think the South Bronx is uppermost in people's minds. That's why I decided to go up there and take a look. I mean, it is a kind of paranoia. It's not constantly on people's minds, but it's somewhere tucked away in the back of the skull at all times, because there's no question but that street crime is worse now than it has ever been.
So let me ask you, are you going to write more novels now?
I haven't decided. The thing that worries me is that toward the end of this book, I was having fun doing it. I've never had fun writing a book.
That worries you?
Yes, because everything else I've done, it has been torture right up to the end, and yet the thing seemed to work out. I figured maybe something went wrong if I actually enjoyed it toward the end of doing it. I finally got to at first I found the flexibility of the novel intimidating. In nonfiction, this nice thing occurs. You're handed the characters, you're handed the plot, and the hard part is bringing it all alive factually. In fiction, you suddenly have this freedom that you can do anything you want with characters. And it worried me a lot at the outset. But toward the end, I began to enjoy the flexibility. But I really haven't decided what I'll do.
Now, you got your doctorate in American Studies. Why did you go into journalism? Not that there's a whole lot of professions waiting for people with doctorates in American Studies.
You put your finger on one part of it, and very few people realize that. Oddly enough, the work I did at Yale to get a doctorate in American Studies turned out to be of inestimable value in journalism. It so happened that I finished my dissertation at the end of one summer, and it was too late to get a job teaching, which is the natural thing for someone in graduate school to do. So I decided, well, I'll do something else for a year and get a job teaching the following year. So I got a job on a newspaper in Springfield, Massachusetts, which is a few miles north of New Haven, and somewhat to my surprise, loved it from the very beginning. I was a general assignment reporter, covering whatever came my way, filling in on the police beat on the weekends, and I really never wanted to leave it once I got started.
You ended up in the features department. Was that considered more trivial than political reporting?
Well, I never actually was confined to feature work, but certainly feature work and general assignment local reporting, which was my real passion, was considered far, far beneath reporting on national and international news. And as a matter of fact, I got a job on the Washington Post immediately when I applied, because I was the only applicant they had had in about 5 years who had walked in and when asked the question, what would you like to do eventually here on the Washington Post, replied, cover local news. They said, you're hired, because the place was full of bitter young men and women who had come to the Washington Post to cover the Defense Department or the Senate or Paris. And I just found local news in the cities of this, covering local news in the cities of this country, a carnival.
You started to use the techniques of fiction to write journalistic stories. What were you reacting against in the style of journalism?
There was a neutral, so-called objective voice that journalists were expected to assume at that time. And there we're getting back to the late 50s and the early 60s. And I frankly found it absolutely boring. I also, having had it in the back of my mind that I was, you know, at some point I was going to quit journalism and write fiction. I mean, that's what everyone interested in writing starts into journalism with. That's the idea. I began to be intrigued with the notion of, well, here I am a journalist. Well, why not use, if it's possible, some of these techniques that short story writers and novelists use while doing nonfiction? And this became a great game and a great experiment, and pretty soon, by the mid-60s, seemed to me much more important than writing fiction. I mean, there was nothing going on in fiction that even remotely compared in excitement with what was going on in what at that time was called the New Journalism.
Was it a sudden thing that got you to write that way? Did you suddenly say, well, I can't write this piece in the old style, I've got to write it in this new style, the old style just won't work? Or did your writing gradually evolve?
No, well, I did have a kind of a involuntary, epiphanal moment in, let's see, what year was it? It was 1963, it must have been. There was a... Late in 62, a newspaper strike began. I was by now working for the New York Herald Tribune, and I suddenly found myself out of a job, and I needed to make some money, so I went over to Esquire magazine and sold them on the idea of a story on customized cars, which at that time were being made in very fanciful forms by teenagers in Los Angeles, the era of Big Daddy Ed Roth and George Barris and so on. So they said, okay, going out to California and do this story. I remember checking into the Beverly Wilshire Hotel, and over the course of 4 weeks running up this enormous bill, I came back to New York, found myself utterly blocked. I could not write this story. I went to the managing editor of Esquire, Byron Dobell, who's now editor of American Heritage, and I told him, I said, Byron, I'm sorry. I just simply cannot write this story. I just have to drop the assignment. He says, you can't do that. We've got about $10,000 worth of color plates of these ridiculous automobiles you're supposed to be writing about on the already made. We can't do anything about that. So why don't you just give us your notes, and we'll get some competent writer to put them together. So with a very heavy heart one night, as a matter of fact, after it must have been after 9 o'clock one night, I started typing up these notes, in the form of a memo which began, "Dear Byron, the first place I saw customized cars was at 18 Fair in North Hollywood, California, as straight as I could do it, but as fast as I could do it to get this humiliating task over with." And I ended up typing at top speed for about 8 or 9 hours. And in that time, I produced 50 typewritten pages. I took this over to Esquire, turned it in about 9 o'clock in the morning, went home to sleep, and I got a call about 4 that afternoon from Byron Dobell saying, "Well, Tom, we're going to knock the Dear Byron off the top of your memo and run the memo as the article." And that article became the one entitled "The Candy-Colored Tangerine Flake Streamlined Baby," which was the title of my first book. What had happened was, in writing what I thought was a memorandum to a single individual who was about my own age, Byron Dobell, that I had somehow liberated myself from all of the fears and all of the constraints that you feel when you are going to write something as formal as a magazine article for a national audience. I had reached that kind of tone that a lot of people are able to reach in writing a letter to a friend. There are many great writers of letters who freeze when they are told to write a course paper.
Well, a lot of people tell you, write it as if you're telling your friend about it. Of course, easier said than done.
Well,
it implies that you're more articulate somehow when you're talking to a friend about it, which isn't, of course, necessarily
not
true.
Not necessarily true, but you are freer, and it'll work the first time for anybody.
Well, that article established a new style for you, which you've been building on for a long time. Now, that style has created real reverberations within journalism, and I want to talk to you a little bit about the legacy of that style. It seems that it spawned a lot of terrific writing, and it spawned a lot of bad writing, too. I don't know if you feel that way. Do you? that there are a lot of excesses that have been...
It can lead to excesses, particularly in the form of purple prose.
Yeah,
it's a very demanding form, and I think a lot of people who try it don't realize how much reporting you have to do first. Without the information behind it, all of these techniques, which are things like scene-by-scene construction and use of extended passages of dialogue and point of view in the Henry James sense, without the facts, which can only be obtained through reporting, it can really fall flat. It just becomes a verbose technique.
There's also a certain kind of novelistic writing that has entered newspapers, where the article might start, "It was 4 a.m. Little Johnny awakened with a start. There was a big noise outside. He looked out the window. War had broken out." And instead of just the headline saying, "War broke out," you have to get through all this descriptive, novelistic writing.
Well, frankly, I don't see it tried enough any longer. I think newspapers particularly tend to be very timid because they don't have to experiment very much any longer. Most towns in the U.S., newspapers have settled down into local monopolies. The great day of this form of writing in newspapers was at the New York Herald Tribune when it was desperately trying to overtake the New York Times. And that's what really started really brilliant work by people like Jimmy Breslin or Gail Sheehy and many others. It didn't, you know, we never overtook the New York Times, but it was we sure made a great show as the ship sank.
My guest is writer Tom Wolfe, who's just written his first novel. It's titled The Bonfire of the Vanities. We're going to talk some more about his work and his life after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
Journalist and novelist Tom Wolfe is my guest. Can I ask you the dread questions about your white suits?
Yeah, now we're getting serious. Yes, go
yeah,
ahead.
Let's get down to real business here. I mean, your signature as far as your wardrobe goes has always been the three-piece suit, tailor-made, usually white. Now, something I've always wondered about wearing a white suit is that you really have to protect yourself because anything is going to get you dirty. And as a journalist, it seems to me you really want to dive into a situation and do what needs to be done. But if you're wearing all white, you have to keep everything at a certain distance.
Well, two things that come to mind when you ask about that. One is, I have discovered that for me, you know, maybe it doesn't work for everybody, for me, it is much more effective to arrive in any situation as a man from Mars than to try to fit in. I've tried, when I first started out in journalism, in magazine work particularly, I used to try to fit in. I remember doing a thing on stock car racing. I went down to North Wilkesboro, North Carolina, to do a story on a stock car racer named Junior Johnson. And I tried to fit into the stock car scene. I wore a green tweed suit and a blue button-down shirt and a black knit tie and some brown suede shoes and a brown Borsellino hat. And I figured that was really casual, really the stock car races. And after about 5 days, Junior Johnson, whom I was writing about, came to me and says, I don't mean to be rude or anything, he says, but people I've known all my life down here in Ingle Hollow, that was where he came from, say, they keep asking me, Junior, who is that little green man following you around? And it was then it had dawned on me that, A, nobody for 50 miles in any direction was wearing a suit of any color, or a tie for that matter, or a hat. And the less said about brown suede shoes, the better, I can assure you. So I wasn't fitting in to start with. I was also depriving myself of the ability to ask some very obvious questions if I thought I fit in. I was dying to know what an overhead cam was. People were always talking about overhead cams, but if you're pretending to fit in, you can't ask these obvious questions. After that, I gave it up. I would turn up always in a suit, and you know, many times a white suit, and just be the village information gatherer. And you'll be amazed if you're willing to strike that role.
When you were doing the research for your book, Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test, which is about Ken Kesey and the psychedelic acid trips, were you dressed like that too?
Oh, yes. And it would have been, actually, to have tried to fit into that scene would have been fatal, perhaps literally fatal. Kesey had this this abiding distaste for pseudo-hippies. Or hipster. There was really no such term at that time, but well, let's call them pseudo hipsters. You know, the journalist or lawyer or teacher who on the weekends puts on his jeans and smokes a little dope and plays some Coltrane records and tries to be part of the scene. And so he had a device called Testing People's Cool. And I remember once witnessing this. It was on one of these weekends. And he said, all right, let's everybody get naked. That was his word for naked. And get on our bikes and go up Route 1. This was in California. And they did. They took off all their clothes. They got on their motorcycles. And they started riding up Route 1. Now, this separated the hippies from the weekend hipsters, if you will, very rapidly. But now I didn't have to worry because I was in my three-piece suit with a big blue corduroy necktie, and the idea that I was going to take any of this off for anybody was crazy. So, you know, I was safe.
You probably just look like another freak to a lot of freaks.
Well, after about 2 weeks, one of the Ken Kesey's group, the pranksters, named Doris DeLay, said to me, you know, you got on the weirdest outfit around here. And it was the most unusual in that particular little corner of the woods.
Would you ever let a journalist observe you, hang out with you? I don't mean just interview you and write a piece about you. Maybe this has happened already. But say a journalist wanted to almost move in with you for a few weeks, really get a sense of your life, follow you around on a story you were writing. Would you let anyone do that?
Probably not. I've never felt that anybody owes me the courtesy or favor of letting me observe them, or that nobody has any obligation to answer my questions. And by the same token, I don't feel I have the obligation to answer anybody else's if I don't want to. I don't think it's an inalienable right of the American press to be cooperated with.
Are you saying that you don't trust journalists?
unless for some reason I really wanted that, and that could, you know, that could occur too. I mean, I could have publicity starvation.
But are you saying that you wouldn't trust someone to come in and watch you, or that you'd just be uncomfortable by it?
I'm not ruling out the possibility of doing such a thing altogether. I'm just sort of stating as a principle that at this moment I probably wouldn't want to do it. The time could come when I might want. You know, most people, if they let the press observe them, are striking an implicit bargain. They feel that they know that there's something in it for the press, and they feel that there's something in it for themselves. And I think we might as well be frank about it. It is some kind of bargain. The outcome of what is written should be a certain thing, but that, okay, I'll give you this freedom of observation in hopes that I'm going to get this particular... I think that's the way it works out.
Well, that leads me to my final question, which is some people probably who got written about by you felt burned afterwards, thinking specifically of the Radical Chic piece that you wrote about a fundraising party for the Black Panthers at Leonard Bernstein's house.
Yes,
and, I'm sure he was sorry that you were there.
Yes, I think he was. I think you have to take, as the journalist, you have to take the position that what you are doing is important. That the process of discovery that you are going through is as important, if not more important, than any issue that is involved in the story that you're writing. And looking back at the story on Leonard Bernstein and the Black Panthers, the story Radical Chic, I think it was important to see exactly how the phenomenon that I called Radical Chic worked, what it was all about, and I think you can't afford to be constantly wringing your hands over the impact of what you're doing, whether you're talking about the impact on the individuals that you're writing about or the impact on the issues that are involved, in this case, support for radical groups in the late 1960s. I was heavily criticized after that for drying up fundraising, which I don't think I did, but drying up fundraising for these radical groups among wealthy people, among socialites in New York. Well, whether I did or I didn't, I don't think you can worry about that. I think if you start worrying about that, you're no longer writing. You're involved in public relations.
Tom Wolfe, I want to thank you very much for sharing some of your ideas with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Tom Wolfe's best-selling novel is titled The Bonfire of the Vanities. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Audrey Hepburn. I hope you can join us. My guest has been Tom Wolfe, who was one of the pioneers of new journalism and has just written his first novel. The novel is called The Bonfire of the Vanities. It's just been published by Farrar, Straus, Giroux. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with David Attenborough. He's made more than 30 natural history films for the BBC and PBS, including the Living Planet and Life on Earth series. So I hope you can join us. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, part two of our interview with Canadian writer Farley Mowat. Today we discuss his adventures in Canada's Northern Territories, researching wolves, whales, and Eskimos. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Nothing Like the Sun, Sting's second solo album since leaving the Police. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the courtroom thriller Suspect, starring Cher and Dennis Quaid. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson. President Reagan announced the name of his new nominee to the Supreme Court today. He is Douglas Ginsburg, a 41-year-old U.S. Federal Appeals Court judge. If he is confirmed, Ginsburg would be the youngest Supreme Court justice since William Douglas joined the court in 1939. Douglas was 40. Today, Ginsburg appeared alongside President Reagan at the White House.
I just want to say that I'm looking forward to the confirmation process, and upon confirmation to taking a place in the court and playing a part in the work that it does that's so important in our system of government.
Ginsburg's nomination was announced just 6 days after the defeat of another Supreme Court nominee, Appeals Court Judge Robert Bork. A bargain-hunting rally pushed stock prices higher on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average climbed more than 91 points to close at 1938.33. Today's surge was broadly based, with gainers outnumbering losers 4-1. Meanwhile, the dollar continued its slide today amid skepticism that leading industrialized nations will be able to stop its decline. The currency fell half a yen in New York and dropped to a 7-year low against the German mark. Today on Capitol Hill, members of the House Banking Committee heard from four highly regarded economists on the impact of the turmoil on Wall Street and what the government should do about it. NPR's Phyllis Crockett has more.
Testifying were John Kenneth Galbraith of Harvard University, Alan Sinai of Shearson Lehman Brothers, Herbert Stein and Martin Feldstein, both former chairmen of the Council of Economic Advisers. All four agreed that government policy could diminish the possibility of a recession in the wake of the stock market crash. And all four agreed that the dollar should be allowed to continue to fall, since economists and investors generally agree the dollar is still too high. Stein said the economy would be hurt if the Federal Reserve tightens monetary policy in order to stabilize the dollar.
Moreover, I think it's important for the Federal Reserve and the administration to reassure financial markets that it will not distort domestic monetary policy in order to support the dollar.
Feldstein said investors worldwide would not risk their funds in American securities until the dollar comes down to acceptable levels. I'm Phyllis Crockett in Washington.
The House today rejected a bid to consider a $23 billion deficit reduction package. Lawmakers voted 217 to 203 against debate rules, ignoring a plea from Speaker Jim Wright to back the package as honest-to-God deficit reduction. But opponents from both parties say the plan would interfere with the compromise budget package being worked out by a bipartisan group of congressional leaders and administration officials. President Reagan said today he will wait until he meets with Soviet Foreign Minister Eduard Shevardnadze to find out whether there will actually be a summit this year. Today, a Soviet spokesman in Moscow told reporters that a summit would take place before the end of the year. Jeremy Harris reports.
The spokesman, Mr. Boris Pyatyshev, said good and constructive work had been done by both sides in the wake of the inconclusive talks held in Moscow last week between the American Secretary of State, Mr. Schultz, and Kremlin leaders. He claimed there was now an understanding between Moscow and Washington that together with an agreement to eliminate medium and shorter-range nuclear weapons, questions relating to strategic arsenals and the Star Wars program would be thoroughly discussed at a summit. That was enough, Mr. Pyatyshev added, for one to take place before the end of the year. When asked whether a date would be set during Mr. Shevardnadze's talks in Washington at the end of the week, the Soviet spokesman said he didn't rule out that possibility.
The BBC's Jeremy Harris. Gunmen shot three French embassy guards in East Beirut today. It's not known who the gunmen are or why they shot the guards. This is Mara Liasson.
This is Fresh Air. Sting has just released his second solo album. The title, Nothing Like the Sun, comes from a line in a sonnet by Shakespeare. Sting first achieved notoriety as lead singer with The Police, and he's also had a second career as an actor in such films as Quadrophenia, Dune, and The Bride. Our rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of Sting's new album.
I don't drink coffee, I take tea, my dear. I like my toast on one side. In my accent when I talk, I'm an Englishman in New York.
Somewhere along the line, Sting started taking himself very seriously. In what amounts to a triumph of imposing one's will upon the people, Sting began putting political commentary into his lyrics and staring at the camera with a big, long boo-boo face, and millions of people fell for it. Presto, a new conscience of modern man. Now comes a new album called Nothing Like the Sun, filled with bloated big statements like this song, They Dance Alone, which Sting has called, quote, a symbolic gesture of protest and grief, unquote, toward the victims of political oppression in Chile.
Why are these women here dancing alone? Why is there the sadness in their eyes? Why are the soldiers here, their faces fixed like stone? I can't see what it is that they despise. Dancing with the missing, they're dancing with the dead. They dance with the invisible ones, their anguish is unsaid. Dancing with their fathers, they're dancing with their sons, dancing with their husbands, they dance alone.
You can hear the aching compassion in Sting's voice as he sings that song, They Dance Alone, and that's just the problem. His self-importance overrides any worthwhile sentiments in the music. The result is something shrill and petulant, the sound of a man unduly proud of his own politics. This is just as true of an even prettier song, whose lyric is another lesson fit for schoolroom use. It's called History Will Teach Us Nothing.
If we seek solace in the prisons of the distant past, security and human systems were told will always, always last. Emotions are the sail, and blind faith is the mast. Without the breath of real freedom, we're getting nowhere fast. If God is dead, and the actor plays his part, his words of fear will find their way to a place in your heart. Without the voice of reason, from the past, things can only get worse.
Virtually all the songs on Nothing Like the Sun are the musical equivalent of the photographs that decorate the album, pictures of the tousle-haired rock star being artfully artless. He stares soulfully into the camera to convey his worry over the human condition. Only once does Sting permit himself some fun, and that's on We'll Be Together, which by no coincidence at all is also the album's hit single. I don't deny Sting's talent as a pop musician, and it's a pleasure most of the time to hear the jazz and reggae-influenced rock created by a band that includes saxophonist Branford Marsalis, as well as cameos by Eric Clapton, Gil Evans, and Dire Straits' Mark Knopfler. It's the solemnity of it all that's so annoying, the pretentiousness with which Sting presents this music. It's a classic case of a star's public persona making it difficult, if not impossible, for you to get past his ego and hear the music. Hey, Sting, lighten up.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. This is Fresh Air. Yesterday, I spoke with Canadian writer and naturalist Farley Mowat about his biography of Dian Fossey, who studied the mountain gorilla. Today, in part two of our discussion, Mowat talks about some of his own adventures in the Canadian wilderness and the causes that he's championed. He's written about Inuit Eskimos, the harp seals of the eastern Atlantic region, and the wolves of the Northwest Territory. He chronicled his time spent living among the wolves in his popular book Never Cry Wolf, which was also made into a film. Mowat was a government biologist when he was sent to investigate if the Arctic wolves were killing off the caribou.
This was a real exposition to me, a terrible one, too, that when I went north as a government biologist in 1946 the first time, I discovered that what I was becoming, in fact, was a hired gun. The government wanted me, as a scientist or pseudoscientist, to prove that the wolves were destroying the caribou, ergo, we should destroy the wolves. And I soon began to discover that this was not true. And when I tried to, when I wrote my reports and indicated that this was not so, I had my knuckles wrapped very smartly. Well, I couldn't stomach that. The hell with that. So I didn't quit. I wrote a long radiogram from a very remote community where there was an army radio in the middle of the Barrenlands to my superiors in Ottawa, telling them that the Inuit, the Eskimos in the area, were dying of starvation, and that something had to be done immediately, and would they do it? And the reaction to that was a three-word telegram, radiogram from my employer saying, "You are fired." Nothing better could ever have happened to me.
I guess that was the last time you ever worked for the government?
That's the last time.
Were you afraid of the wolves when you first got up north?
I was very apprehensive about them. I'd been conditioned all my life to the wolf myth. And I really thought that by going out all by myself and walking into their territory that I was risking mutilation and death and being eaten. It took a long time for me to understand that they would accept me if I would accept them.
Did an animal ever surprise you and attack you?
No wild animal has ever attacked me. The only animals that have ever attacked me have been human animals. And I know how to deal with them. I either run like hell or kick them in the crotch. But I have never been bothered by a wild animal under any circumstances.
Did you ever feel that living out in the Arctic alone or on any of your other adventures, that you were going to get isolated or antisocial?
Maybe slightly human antisocial. But the great thing about having contact with the other animals is you're never lonely. You can't speak to them in the English language or whatever language you have, but you can speak to them through emotions, you can speak to them subjectively, and you can hear them subjectively. I became involved with a whale at one point in my life, out of which came a book called A Whale for the Killing. And this was a gigantic fin whale, a 70-footer, trapped in a lagoon by high tides near the little fishing village where I lived in Newfoundland. And I immediately set out to try and rescue this whale, which was being used for target practice by some of the locals. And it was a long fight, and I lost. The whale died. But there were moments during that communication, during that period, when there was direct communication between me and the whale, and it came from the whale. I was aware, and don't ask me through what senses I was aware of the fact that that whale, that enormous animal, knew that I was trying to help it, and it tried to cooperate. I would think of a way of perhaps trying to get it through the narrow passage. And the whale would move to that narrow passage and would try to force its way through. It was a daunting experience of the fact that other animals have sensitivities, have communications, have comprehension. And we refuse to accept that because we want to remain the dominant animal upon this planet. We cannot give them an inch.
You know, I'm thinking that you've just written a biography of Diane Fossey, who studied the mountain gorilla in Africa. And all of your work that I know of has been in very cold regions, mostly around the Arctic. Is that a function of you having been born in Canada, or is there another reason why you've kept most of your research and your crusades in really cold territories?
Well, I'm a creature of a cold climate. There's no question about it. And I get banana-brained if the weather gets too hot. I feel very ill at ease and uncomfortable. So, since the world is big, and the northern parts of it are enormous, there's been lots of opportunities for me without going south.
I'm almost tempted to ask you for some suggestions on how to keep warm in the winter.
Well, it's very simple. Eat a lot of fat and take 3 ounces of vodka for every degree that the temperature drops.
Thanks, I'll try it. You have been denied entrance to the United States under the McCarran-Walter Act, which basically denies access to anarchists, communists, and anyone deemed, quote, prejudicial to the public interest, unquote. Were you surprised that you weren't going to be allowed into America? This was, what, in 1985?
Yeah. Yeah, I was shattered because, you know, I've done all the things that I'm not supposed to do. But the reason, apparently, that I was stopped at the border in 1985, having crossed the border hundreds of times before, was that I'd written a book called Sea of Slaughter, which is it's almost a diatribe against hunting and against the people who like guns. And this got me into very hot water with the various big organizations that support hunting and guns, the lobbies in Washington. And there seems to be some reason to conclude that they brought pressure to bear on the INS to exclude me. When the American press rose to my defense, which it did, God bless it, the American media, and made a national issue of this, the INS had to depart from its tradition of secrecy, of never saying why they exclude people, and was forced to come up with something. And so what they came up with, of course, you may know about it, they accused me of being a threat to the United States Armed Forces. And this was
based
on the
on
basis
what?
Of a statement I had made in 1962, at which time B-52 bombers with hydrogen bombs in their bellies crossed over my house every day, heading towards Arctic, Russian targets, actually. This was called the fail-safe system, and they were recalled at certain points. And I found this intolerable. They hadn't asked my permission to fly over my bloody house with their hydrogen bombs. So I stated to a reporter, I'd had a drop perhaps too much, or maybe not enough, that if they didn't stop this damn nonsense, or at least get my permission, that I was going to blast them out of the skies with my little .22 rifle. You know, they were flying 5 miles up. But unfortunately, I had neglected a basic truth that I know very well, and that is that bureaucrats do not have any sense of humor. How can they? Their heads are full of cement. So this was produced anyway as the real reason for my exclusion.
Do you think that will get lifted and that you will be allowed to come back to America?
It would be very difficult for the INS and the State Department to backtrack. But what I have been told unofficially by my own Department of External Affairs is that they hear that if I want to cross the American border at any time, nobody is going to say boo. But that's not good enough, you know. I don't play games that way. When and if somebody in the State Department, and I keep lowering my sights, I initially said it had to be the president. Now I'll take it from anybody senior in the State Department that they made a mistake and that they used calumny on me and gave me bad reputation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Then I will consider re-entering the United States physically. The funny thing about this is, of course, the stupidity of this of the McCarran-Waters Act is I am excluded physically, but my voice is not excluded, my books are not excluded, my ideas are not excluded. I have as much free access to your country as you do to ours. It's only my body that they keep out. Well, you know, I don't feel any great sense of loss.
You don't feel any sense of loss being kept out of America?
No, the world's a very large place, and this is the only place I'm kept out. So, you know, I can roam freely wherever else I wish to go.
Where will you be roaming next?
I'm going to Fiji. Fiji looks like an interesting place to go right now because, as you know, they've had some problems there. And there are two reasons why I'm going. One is that the tourists will all be scared off, so I'll have the place to myself. And the second is that, at the moment, they don't have a governor general, so the job is open, and I don't see why the hell I shouldn't apply.
Well, happy travels, and thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Bye now.
Farley Mowat's new book is a biography of Diane Fossey titled Woman in the Myths, published by Warner Books. He spoke to us from the Toronto studios of the CBC. You're listening to Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. John Hockenberry, who's co-hosting the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, John.
Hi, Terry.
What story are you following?
The White House has released the name of the person it wants to nominate to the Supreme Court to replace Lewis Powell now that the Bork nomination has been rejected, and it's an unlikely choice. No one really expected it. A report also on the Strategic Defense Initiative, the Star Wars plan, some recommendations from the Pentagon today, and a profile of a record label for folkies, but they have to play new songs. No kumbaya allowed. And the story of Uncle Egbert.
Is this your Uncle Egbert?
I must confess, it's my Uncle Egbert, and I'm going to tell all tonight.
Okay, thanks, John. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Suspect is a new thriller starring Cher and Dennis Quaid. The film was directed by Peter Yates, whose credits include Bullet with Steve McQueen, Breaking Away, The Dresser, and The Deep. Our film critic Stephen Schiff has this review of Suspect.
There's absolutely nothing in this movie that you haven't seen 100 times before. The struggling pro bono underdog lawyer, the unsympathetic judge, the patently innocent defendant who doesn't have a chance, the fiends who will do anything to make sure the case isn't solved. Suspect is a string of clichés and formulas, and yet it entertained me throughout. Maybe courtroom thrillers are like Christmas lights. If they're well strung and symmetrically draped, they still work on you no matter how many times you've seen them. Suspect stars Cher as a Washington lawyer assigned to defend a hulking but helpless derelict, accused of murdering a young law clerk. When it's time to select the jury, among the candidates is a fast-talking lobbyist, played by Dennis Quaid.
Mr. Sayer, you've stated that you are a congressional advisor. Is that another word for lobbyist?
I don't know. That's sort of like calling a lawyer a mouthpiece, isn't it?
Would you turn around, Mr. Sanger?
Excuse me?
Just turn around and face the back of the courtroom, please. Mr. Sanger, could you tell me what color my hair is?
Brown.
Does my hair look brown to you?
You asked me what color your hair was. I thought you wanted the real color.
You're very observant.
This is Dennis Quaid's third knockout performance this year. And though he's not quite as extravagant here as he was in The Big Easy, he's still seductive and loose, and beneath all his confident jive, touchingly vulnerable. In Suspect, he's a juror who's inordinately interested in the outcome of the case. He even starts investigating on his own and trying to slip Cher the evidence he finds. All of which is quite illegal, of course, since it opens Cher up to charges of jury tampering. Quaid knows how to use his boyishness to bring a surprising amount of sexual tension into a scene. And that, in part, is what keeps Suspect moving, which is a lucky thing, since the movie has to skip along pretty briskly to make it over the plot holes. Why, for instance, is Quaid risking his life, and Cher's career, to gather evidence? Why doesn't he just wait until the jury meets, and then, with his lobbyist's powers of persuasion, convince them to acquit the defendant? At worst, he can hold out for a hung jury. The movie half-heartedly makes us think he's doing it because he's so attracted to Cher, but getting her disbarred is not the world's most effective seduction technique. Well, Alfred Hitchcock used to complain about what he called the plausibles. Those moviegoers so busy charting plot problems that they missed whatever was endearing about the film. The plausibles would have a field day with Suspect, but no matter. The director, Peter Yates, uses Washington's seediest back alleys and clammiest winterscapes to tighten his grip. And the screenwriter, Eric Roth, has provided plenty of invigorating inside-the-beltway chit-chat that livens the movie up around the edges. Best of all is Cher. I had worried about her in this part. She's a wonderful and eccentric comedienne, and I had thought that casting her in such a straight-laced suspense role would have bleached out everything colorful in her personality. On the contrary, though, she brings her particular brand of forthrightness and dignity to the role, without sacrificing her throaty sexuality. In Suspect, she proves what she's been trying to prove for most of her professional life, that she's not just a novelty act, she's a real actress.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Here's a look at the next fresh air. Next time, I'll speak with syndicated political cartoonist Dan Wasserman. He'll tell us who's getting the cartoonist vote for president. Critic at large Laurie Stone will discuss comic Mort Saul's one-man Broadway show, and Brazilian guitarist Orlando Haddad will be back to perform an original composition. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton are the production assistants. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Our engineer is Orji Voblaitis. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.